Session number 28704, Reel 5.
Right.
Reel 5.
Yeah, so what happened is that Yugoslavia was over here, shall we say, to our right-hand side. The battle line in Italy itself, you know, was further up north. And you passed over that when you were going up north to, say, Austria or northern Italy, Verona, for example. You would pass over the battle line and, you know, at least... Well, it was just a mark on the map as we were concerned. But I thought you raised a very interesting point there, to be honest. You're off the war, we're not in it. If I could revert back to the fact that when we're in the Western Desert, and I was in ground staff, we had planes which were operational, and we were up in Misurata, up in North Africa, and they were attacking the Greek islands and shipping. And any German planes that were trying to ferry people across. The point is this, is that as ground crew, you're not really involved in the situation as such, if I can put it that way. Your job in life is to service the planes, and you do that, and then you walk away. I mean, this is putting it in, you know, stark terms. You walk away. The people, the crews, which were bullfighters, they take off, they go, they complete their mission and come back again, and that's that. But the ground crew are never really brought into the picture. They don't know the target, they're never told the target, because it's hush-hush, I suppose. They're never told afterwards, you know, what's happened, where they've been and what's happened. Only now and again do you get snatches of stories coming out that somebody's picked up. So in a funny old way, you know, you're excluded, you know, from the actual war. You know, you're not getting the feeling that you're involved. I mean, there's never a notice put up saying, well, you know, yesterday, you know, 20 or whatever it is of our aircraft attacked shipping in the Mediterranean and the result was such and such. You know, there's no feedback of information to you. So therefore, in a sense, you know, ground crews are isolated, and I'm sure you just don't get the feeling that you know you're in the war, you're off the war, but you know, not in it, if I can put it that way. You see, the situation that, well, in any military organization, you have the officers, you have the NCOs, and then you have the other ranks. That's what I said to Steve. It's a bit like upstairs, downstairs sort of syndrome. You know that that's your job functioning to keep the planes flying. But there's no relationship between you, say, and the officers, you know, or indeed, partially only between the crews. If there's a problem arises during the flight, electrical or radio, then okay, they'll contact you then, and perhaps, but that'll probably be done through an NCO. So there's a gap. There's always that gap between the officers and the other people. And as I said before, there's no sort of saying, well, lads, this is what we did yesterday, or this is what we're going to do today. You're excluded from that situation altogether, you know. Mm. And I sometimes wonder whether is that really best thing for any esprit de corps, you know. You're not fully in, you know, functioning as a unit. You know, you're kept in the dark a little bit. Mm. Anyway, that's by the way. But, you know, I think it's a point worth making, actually, yeah. Whereas when I went to air crew, of course, it was quite a different situation. In turn, we did not have anything to do with the ground staff because we had no need to. I mean, they serviced the plane and that was that. And we just simply walked away from the plane and we came back the next day and, you know, we didn't really have any kind of contact at all with them at all. And but that's just the way the system works. That you just have to accept that on our situation. But anyway, I made the point, so I don't know.
When you supplied the partisans, you dropped everything by parachute?
Everything by parachute, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. And what happened was that you can see from here that, well, you should be able to see. You see, they see the cross there.
Oh, yes. So the photograph here, the marked cross on the ground.
Yeah, well, what happened was the partisans laid out that cross, And you dropped your supplies on there, and they picked it up, and then that was that. I mean, it sounds quite easy, but the liberator, the wimpy, there were still some wimpies operating then, and it seemed that they were more equipped for the job. Mm-hmm. The wimpies, you know, flying more. They used to fly quite low.
What height would you drop this stuff, the parachutes from?
1,700 feet.
Well, it's really quite low, so you're quite vulnerable at that height, aren't you?
Yeah, and the Liberator is not a plane designed to fly at low altitudes. And part of the fact, I remember going to one briefing, and there was quite a heated discussion from some of the pilots as to whether, you know, the kind of feasibility of it, because lots of cloud about, and you know, could they do this and could they do that? And after all, it was a Liberator, and asking it to drop down through a hole in the cloud, you know, wasn't really what they wanted to do, I think. And there was at one time quite a heated discussion, about this, and one with a. I mean, the supply was. Well, at the end of the day, you go there, and if you can drop, you drop. And if in your judgment there's a problem, that's entirely up to the pilot. Whether he's prepared to do that. I mean, 1,700 feet is nothing for a Liberator. As I say, I don't think any of them thought it was really designed for that particular operation.
Did you lose a lot of planes in those days?
You lose a lot. Well, I don't really know, to be honest, because losses and anything like that was never talked about. My recollection is I thought amongst my particular people that we hadn't lost a lot of planes on supply dropping. That was my impression at all. I think I'm not quite sure about the Wimpy's other squadrons. They may very well have done so, but
and the Wimpy is a name for Wellingtons, is it? Wimpy.
Sorry, Wellington is Wimpy is Wellington. Wimpy's. Yeah, Wimpy's are Wellingtons, and so no. My impression that the group that I was with survived by and large, but what happened elsewhere, I couldn't really comment on that. Because we weren't all in the same aerodrome. There were two aerodromes, and when we arrived by people, the parting of the ways when one went in, and the other went into their ones, and that. And that was quite a business as well sometimes. You know, lots of planes all coming in, all circling around, and I think people were a bit worried about they started bumping into one another.
Did you have any friendly fire incidents?
Sorry?
Did you have any friendly fire incidents?
No, we didn't. The only thing that we had was on the one trip up to northern Italy. I remember it quite well. That much to my horror, I mean, was one of our own planes just passed right over the top of us. And when I read about these 1,000 bomber raids over Germany, I'm sure there must have been some people bumping into the, I've never heard of it. Well, I can know for a fact it did happen. Anyway, that what happened was that if we know where they're going for the bombing run, one plane up above dropped its bombs on the plane down below. And that was featured in the picture post, you know, the now defunct picture post. Yeah, that was at that place there. But fortunately, of course, it didn't go off. But all it did was it sliced down past where the wireless operator was. But I would have thought another couple of feet later, I would have taken down the aircraft itself. You know.
Did it manage to get home?
Oh yeah, they managed to get home all right. I'm not quite sure that was it, but there was damage done, and there was bits and pieces knocked off the aircraft. But what happened was, obviously, the bomber was not aware of the fact that the plane was down immediately. He'd be looking, far out, and I would think that I don't think he can be blamed for that. But yeah, they survived the situation. But it was, as I featured in the picture post. Now, whether that was a real occasion, it was as far as we were concerned, but whether it ever happened again, I don't really know. I can imagine it as a possibility of that happening.
Would you like to describe to me what a typical night bombing raid would have been like?
I've already described how you've been briefed and you've gone into you've had your briefing, you're in the plane, you take off and you head off for wherever the target is, and it's a strange sort of situation, is that you're flying out there, you think you're on your own, but you're not. There's other aircraft all round about you. But as far as we're concerned, our main worry was when we got to the target, where we didn't perhaps get any real opposition on the way up, but it was all concentrated, over the target. But you're just sitting there in the absolute darkness, and you can't see anything. There's no ground features to distinguish anything. You just sit there, and then as you move into the target, then usually. Depending how alert they are, usually the situation was, the anti-aircraft fire would open up, and that was it. Take your chance, really. I mean, just going through it, if it was a kind of box barrage, they were just flinging it up, and they usually had your height anyway. I mean, they knew you were coming in, and they were obviously waiting on you. And as I say, as soon as the first one appeared over the target, it was normal for the anti-aircraft fire to start opening up right away. The thing, you can't always, depending on the conditions, you can see it bursting at night round about you, quite close, and one thing and another. But as I say, what you do is, you're waiting there. You're getting tense at that point. When you're waiting, minutes before you arrive there, you can hear the navigator saying, we're coming up to the target now. At one time, of course, we used the pathfinders. Earlier days we didn't, but at that stage, you tense up. You're wanting to get in, and you're wanting to get back out again. And then what happens is, I say, you go into the target, and the anti-aircraft comes flying up, and you can hear the bomber but now taking over, telling the pilot, the course, and steady, steady, or something, and all that. And then the bomb doors open, and they're running up into the target, and it seems like an eternity, and then when he says bombs away, then all that is, close the bomb doors and get out, tamper home. There's one here, I remember going up and, maybe here, I'm not quite, anyway, what happened was that going up into the target, the wireless operator used to come down and pull the handle, and the doors would slide up. Anyway, we're running into the target, and then we hear the bomb aimer, giving them the last minute instructions, and then next thing was bombs away, and the pilot went to now all of a sudden there was a small voice piped up belonging to the wireless operator saying, "Sorry, skipper, I forgot to open the bomb doors." I will not describe what the pilot called them, but not to be repeated in polite circles.
So had the bombs actually...
Well, what happened was, the bomb aimer, when he didn't get the right response, was the half of the call, a jettison bar on his bombs, and if it doesn't go, that'll take everything away, and obviously he thought that, he'd done the right thing. Whether the pilot had sensed the plane wasn't lighter, I'm not quite sure anyway. But, the wireless operator said right away, he said, "I'm sorry, skipper," he said, "I forgot to open the bomb doors," which meant, of course, we had to drop them, and of course it meant that we had to go way back round again, like the same, through the same procedure again, before it wasn't, before we could, clear the target, drop the bombs and clear the target, and... But certainly the skipper wasn't
impressed,
and neither were the rest of us, quite frankly. I mean, we had enough,
It's double jeopardy, isn't it?
Well, once you go through that, that's enough. We don't want to really go back through it again. And anyway, I suppose eventually all was forgiven. And but it's a funny business. I think in a sense you get used to it. You know what? See, you tense up, and you want to... I think you just really want to get through it and do the job. And
as the flak breaks or goes off around you, does it light it right up where you are? And
it goes right up with you because they've got your height. Mm. I mean, they're not fools. They've got the equipment. They've got the height, and they just open up on you. If you're in first, I think fair enough. I mean, you probably got off lightest, but. You never know. I can tell you one other incident, if I may. We went, I think it's here actually, I'm sure it is. Okay. Well, what happened here was that they went into the briefing room, as per usual. I'd gone through the formalities and had been briefed and were ready to go. And as we were about to go out the door, the group captain, who not normally a flying man, I think they're only allowed to do certain operations. He came, a little chap, Baird or something, we used to call him Teddy Bear, you know, and anyway, he came bounding over and, and said to our pilot, "Right, Kelly," he said, "I'm coming with you today." You see? And I went, "Oh, wow, really?" And he said, "I just got on the phone here." You see, I'd obviously got on the phone here. He got on the phone and he said, "Can I speak to the AOC, Air Officer Commanding, you know, God, virtually, you know, do they really exist?" Anyway, whatever poor unfortunate individual had answered the phone, he shouted at him, "Get off the phone," he said, "I want to speak to the AOC." So the guy obviously did that. And so this group captain said in a very kind of sotto voice, "You know, Bear here, sir. Permission to fly today?" And Lo obviously said yes right away. And so on we went. We got out to our aircraft. He didn't come with us. I mean, he obviously had his own transport. I mean, you know, travelling a truck with us wasn't a done thing, obviously. Anyway, off we go. And this was the target at the moment. And on the surface, it looked quite, you know, straightforward.
Relatively. Which is a river.
A river there with a railway bridge. And obviously the Germans were using it. And it was needed to them because they were prepared to defend it. So anyway, we were got to the target, okay. And I was sitting there in the turret, you know, looking straight back as usual, you know.
So you faced backwards, did you?
I was facing out of the way. I was facing out of the way, and all of a sudden, I saw two anti-aircraft bursts dead astern of us, actually on our level, you know, just a 1-2 bang bang, absolutely on our level, dead astern. So at that point I shouted to the captain, "Drop your height," you know, told him to drop his height and weave. I mean, there was no time for anything else because really the next lot were coming up anyway, but it was just sufficient to save us. Because what happened was the next lot, I looked out the turret window, and I could see that aircraft shell bursting outside the turret window, just like that. I mean, it's so close. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw another one there, and it just missed the trailing edge. The trailing edge is the, you know, the plane. That's the wing. That's the trailing edge. Is the back end of it. You know, where the flaps come down. And I happened to be looking at this one bursting right outside the window. Actually, no more than that. I could see one had just burst, and I just missed our trailing edge by a matter of a foot or so. But what happened up front was, as soon as I started yelling, you know, and giving instructions for an invasion, the group captain, who had been sitting beside the pilot in the flight engineer's chair, decided that this was not for him. Well, you know, he couldn't be there, so he immediately, apparently, jumped out and told the flight engineer to get back into his seat again in case he was needed. And but fortunately, you know, he wasn't. And but that was about the closest. Now, see, that was daylight, and that's about as close you can get to seeing them bursting on you like that.
Did you get like a concussion in the glass?
No, nothing at all. Just bursting. Unfortunately, with anti-aircraft shells, of course, they're usually going up the way. You know. Anyway, it was all so quick. The whole thing happened so quick. And fortunately, you know, by reacting to it quite quickly, you know, I'm sure that, you know, with a bit of luck, we did avoid it. I mean, I think it would stuck on the course where we were, you know, we could have been in real trouble. I mean, just to see them coming one, two, and I thought, well, where is the next one going to go? You know, it looks as if it's going to be destined for us. Anyway, as I say, all was well. We got away, and then we didn't have a scratch at all, no damage done whatsoever. But when we got back down, the group captain jumped out the plane and marched off and said goodbye, and that was it. But I think if he had been expecting an easy ride, I think he was sadly disillusioned. But the point is this, is that that's the thing about it. You never know what can happen. You know, some things can look relatively straightforward and easy and turn out to be nothing at all. And other times you can run straight through a barrage and not get anything. And
did you have any close calls with German fighter planes?
Only one occasion. When we were over Hungary, and
was that again for dropping for partisans?
Oh, no problem with the partisans. No.
But you were dropping. Was that was
dropping? That, yeah, yeah, just dropping. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. But did I think you mentioned fighter? Did you mention?
Yes.
No, yeah. Not over there. No problem at all. Usually that was fairly straightforward, to be honest, that the partisans had obviously selected a site which would be relatively safe from the interference by the Germans. It had obviously worked out, because the Germans were all over the place, and they were fighting in isolated pockets, one presumes. I mean, it wasn't a battle with battle lines and fixed lines or anything like that. It was, you know, more guerrilla, it was obviously guerrilla fighting. But anyway, so far I was there, I would obviously pick a spot, you know, which was relatively reasonably safe for dropping. So not so much from their point of view, I think, but from their point of view is that they could come and collect and disappear off the scene as quickly as possible, actually, because obviously the Germans you know, would be looking for that. And somebody did tell me that was it Steve that told me that somebody lost about 6 planes doing a supply drop or something like that. So I don't know when that was. To be honest, I think really what happens when your air crew, I think you get the situation of where, well, you know, you do your bit and we've done our bit, let's get out of it. I think that's the feeling. Because the thing is, there's not. When you take off, as I say, you're on your own. Although you know there's other aircraft about, you know, you never get the impression at night time.
You don't talk to each other on the phone.
There's absolute silence. There's, you know, nothing is said in the radio, and so you're again, you're in isolation. You're on your own, and you know, yes, there are other aircraft there, but you know, you don't see them, and you get very much into the situation where we're, you know, you're on your own.
So when the night fighters come, you've no prior warning, they just appear?
No, the only one at the time that we had was over Hungary, funny enough. We knew the night fighters were operating there, and of course, I added obviously very much more to the attention of the situation. So when we got up near the target, we could see that the Germans had searchlights operating, not on us. They were just waving. And I had previously read that this was some means of telling the German fighters, you know, which way the bomber stream, you know, were moving, and that. I'm not quite sure if I can believe that. We thought it had much more sophisticated equipment than that, radar and what have you. Anyway, what happened was that they were moving into the target, and the wireless operator, he always seemed to figure in our moments of tension. I heard the big brother shouting, "I see a German fighter, I see a German fighter." So I said to him, if you tell us where he is, he said, we'll know what to do about him, you know, because, I mean, he could be coming anyway. So he said to me, 7 o'clock, you know, looking at the clock, 7 o'clock. I said, okay then. So I said, right, I said, 7 o'clock. So I swung the turret around to 7 o'clock, and you know, we're going this way. I'm looking out, and I'm looking down at 7 o'clock. And I said, I'm looking at there. I said, I can't see anything. Then the next minute, this German 109 shot past, going in the opposite way. And we were going this way, about 240 miles an hour, and he was going the other way. And I was honestly taken by surprise, you know, because I was looking out this way, and it was as if he had come up behind me, which he hadn't done, actually. And I thought, and the time, it was, the chance was gone just like that. You know, it was either I to open up there and then, but because I was, honestly, I was taken a bit by surprise, I thought, you know, well, it had gone, the opportunity had gone. So I reported that to the pilot. I said, oh, he's got off now. So then when I followed him out, I could see it had gone away out from us. I mean, because, you know, the parting speeds were so large. And then I saw him turning right round again. You know, well, because a fighter is going, I mean, he can't turn it in the sixpence, you know, he's got to go, you know, he's got to go way out. And I thought, oh my God, you know, he's coming back for us. And at that moment in time, I thought, oh dear, I can always remember that. And the pit absolutely dropped out of the bottom of my stomach, actually. I mean, they say that's what happened, it's absolutely true. I thought, well, you know, and I remember saying to myself, well, I could die here tonight. I mean, that was my exact, what I said to myself. I thought, he's coming back. I thought, yeah, I said to myself, you could die here tonight, you know. And so what I did was sort of collected myself a bit. And to be absolutely sure about it, I ordered the pilot to take evasive action, you know, to corkscrew about. And he never got back to us again. They must have seen us. I mean, how could he possibly have missed us? He nearly ran into us. And but I was always left with a nagging doubt, you know, should I have opened fire on him? And but then I thought, you know, well, it was either a quick, the situation looked like a quick burst, and maybe I might have got him, I might have not, but anyway, I made the decision not to do it. And then when I saw him turning around again and coming back in, I thought, oh, you know, well, this was it. I thought, it's not going right here. And I really kind of didn't like the prospect, to be quite honest about it. I thought, well, I could die here tonight, you know. And I suppose fear did grip me, actually. And but anyway, I kept ahead enough to say, come on, you know. And I told the pilot to take evasive action, and that maybe helped, I don't know, but certainly he never got back on to us again. And we got back home safe and sound. And but really, I don't think I ever got over that.
I was going to say, were you shocked afterwards?
Yeah, I was really I honestly never got over it after that. All the operations I did.
Did it make you jumpy?
Well, I think it did, actually. I think it did, yeah, because I felt towards the end of the tour, I was getting a bit kind of, a bit nervy. And
How many operations did you have to do in a
30,
tour?
I did the 30. Mm. 20 in this country, 30 overseas, because they reckoned that the degree of danger was less in Italy than over Europe. But we know that because they had their troubles much long before they got the target than we did. But anyways, as I say, I don't think I've ever got over that. I still think about it today, actually. I still think about the situation, and did I do right? Did I do wrong? You know, I thought, was I right? Was I wrong? I mean, they're so close to us. I mean, I could actually see the pilot's head. You know, it was. I could see his head just above the cockpit, above his cockpit. And
you might have been lucky, you might have just run out of fuel and Was that the end of his?
Well, I don't know. Well, it was one of these situations you have to make up your mind, split, and I chose the not to. And but when I saw him turning round and coming back, I thought, oh no, no, this is not right, you know. And as I said, nowhere. And I still think about that today. It's one of the things I've taken. I mean, it sounds stupid, you know, about 60 odd years later. It's one of the one things I still think about, you know. It could have all been so wrong. I mean, the business about the anti-aircraft fire, well, okay, we had no option. I mean, you could fire guns at you. Well, I mean, you're in there, you haven't.